So good to see all of you here today. For those of you who are visiting here with us, we're glad that you were able to join us today. For those who are with us online, thank you for joining us on this special day. If you have your Bibles, I invite you to open up to Luke chapter 24, and we'll be reading verses 1 through 12. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. They found the stone rolled away from the tomb, but when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were wondering about this, suddenly two men in clothes that gleamed like lightning stood beside them. And in their fright, the women bowed down with their faces to the ground. But the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He is risen. Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee, 'The Son of Man must be delivered over to the hands of sinners, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again.' Then they remembered his words. When they came back from the tomb, they told all these things to 11 and to all the others. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the others with them who told this to the apostles. But they did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense. Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away, wondering to himself what had happened." I have good news and bad news for you this morning. Let's start with the bad news. The story of Jesus' death and resurrection don't make sense. I know that I am not supposed to say that to you, and that I'm sure I am breaking some part of my contract by confessing to you that these things do not make sense. But Jesus doesn't make a lot of sense. And it's a little hard to deny when we read the account of his resurrection, and when all these people had been with him for this time, when the women who went and found the empty tomb go back and tell the disciples what had happened, to them it sounds like what? Nonsense. Why does it sound like nonsense? Because it doesn't make sense. That's what nonsense is. There is no sense. His life, his presence here on earth, if you believe the story and you believe all of these things, there has to be some part of you that recognizes as you read this that it does not all add up. In many ways, and I mean this sincerely, it is a ridiculous story that defies logic, the dynamics of power, and the rules of nature. I'm sure you're aware of this, but the world that we live in has rules. There are laws, dynamics that govern everything we do, and these rules can cover a lot of ground. For example, we have societal rules for the way we are to act when we are in public. And I don't know who needs to hear this morning. I have some suspicions, but wearing pants in public is not a suggestion, correct? It is a societal rule. Now, don't be that person that is trying to come up with the exception to that rule. You're better than that, and just let me get through what I'm doing here this morning. We have laws which set a structure for what we can and cannot do to one another, and some of those laws are subjective to a degree. For example, the law says that we are not to speed while we are on the freeway. We all consciously choose to break that law. I mean, if you just did it once, maybe it was an accident. But with the number of times that we have all sped on the freeway, we all know it's not. But here's the thing about this rule. If you go 7 miles over the speed limit, you're probably good. On the freeway, right? You're probably good and you're not going to be pulled over. However, if you go 9 miles over the speed limit, you are now in some sort of area of greater risk. Why is it this way? I don't know. And yet, we all know that this is true. There are laws that are not so wishy-washy, however. For example, murder is always frowned upon, and you get no credit for only murdering one person as opposed to seven. It's always bad. Besides all of that, we each have all of our own personal rules which dictate the kind of life that we live. Some of the biggest marital fights that people have occurred over how to load the dishwasher, the way the toilet paper should hang, or how you squeeze toothpaste out of the tube. And in each of these cases, those who claim righteousness, and you know who you are, cannot understand why the offender would do something so atrocious, so against the laws of nature, which leads us to the last section, which is, in fact, the laws of nature. If you throw something up in the air, it will come down. There is perhaps no law or rule that is greater than the law, however, of life and death. Death is a law unto itself, and it wins every time. It doesn't matter whether you are young or old, healthy or sick. Death always has the final word. So you see the problem, don't you? The story of Jesus takes the rules, some of them that were given to us and some that we have so carefully laid out, and declares that for God, they are not actually rules. In fact, they might not even be suggestions. Now, to our minds, trying to imagine something who is outside all of these things, it doesn't quite make sense. But here's the thing I want you who believe in Jesus in this room to know today, is that if you act like the story of Jesus is a normal, sensical story, you are doing disservice to yourself, the person you are talking to, and to the story itself. And when we try to do that, try to make this story some sort of average, normal story, we deny what it is, because here is the kicker. If the story of Jesus made perfect sense to us, it would have been a different story altogether. And it would not be the story that we have. The fact, then, that it doesn't make sense might be one of the most important things about it. Jesus was good and dead. The story is clear about that point. There were many witnesses to his death. He, we are told, was dead on the cross that day. And it was confirmed that he was dead on the cross because someone stabbed him in the side and his blood had already begun to separate. Jesus was dead. And many don't really have a problem with this assertion that he was dead and that the crucifixion led to the death of Jesus. His body was taken down from the cross, placed in a tomb. That tomb was sealed, and we even know to whom the tomb belonged. There is no debate, even, that when the disciples showed up that day, the tomb was empty. These details are kind of trivial in the great scheme of things, and there's really no need to argue about them because on their surface they are all totally acceptable. Until you say that the body of Jesus was not there because, yes, he died, but he rose again. Now, there have been a lot of ways that people have tried to explain this. I've actually shared this example with you before, but I want to share it with you again because it's so appropriate. So this is what this person said. There are clues in the gospel, evidence from Jewish historians, belief and the transmigration of souls and well-documented examples of erroneous declarations of death, which combine to support a natural explanation for the Easter story. In other words, here's probably what actually happened on that day. Number one, Jesus survived his short stay on the cross. He was not really dead. And two, was discovered to be barely alive by the few followers who took his body down to go and be put in the tomb. Fearful because they had illegally retrieved a condemned man, they carry out a decoy burial in a tomb. So they put something else in there. We're not told what that something else is. Perhaps nothing, perhaps the Shroud of Turin, who knows? But something is there in the tomb. And soon after that, Jesus does in fact die and is buried quietly somewhere in an anonymous grave. But rumors of his survival reaches the followers as well as the Romans, who open the tomb to find it empty except for burial linen used as the decoy. And the reason why the Romans would have had to gotten involved in this is that it took something to move the stones away from the tomb. So this is the explanation for why the stone would have been moved. So to make everyone feel better, the disciples seize on the rumor of Jesus' survival and encourage each other to hear the voice and see the image of their master in others. So this is one explanation for how the story that we read and believe is not actually true. And here's what the author concludes at the end. Although the probability of this scenario is low, it is surely far larger than the supernatural one. Meaning what? It's easier to believe that the Three Stooges here took Jesus down and went through all these machinations than it is to believe that something like being raised from the dead actually happened. And in this person's mind, it thoroughly explains an alternative story in measured, step-by-step, yes, they are numbered, points. And the question we need to ask is why did the person feel the need to write this? Well, it's because this person looked at the world around them and they recognized some pretty basic things. Number one, death is final. Number two, resurrection is impossible. And if death is final and the resurrection is impossible, then just on its own, the story is not true. If these things are not possible, then the story is not true. The miraculous is taken off the table. And what's funny is even this person who wrote this doesn't believe that what he wrote is plausible. But it's still more plausible than what Christians claim actually happened on that day. To put it to you more simply, a friend once asked me, "Do you really believe that Jesus died and rose from the dead?" And I said, "Yes, I do this professionally. I believe that professionally." And they said, I just find that so hard to believe because you're a pretty smart guy. And I don't know how someone who's pretty smart like you could believe this is true." To which I replied, thanks. My friend was right, though. It doesn't make sense. There's a bottom line to this entire discussion, though, that is an absolute must. And if you are going to progress any further with believing in any of these things, there are some other things that you have to believe. Number one, you have to believe that there is a God. And number two, you have to believe that that God is not restrained by the same things that we are. That he is above all of those things. If you can't accept that, then Don't worry about the rest of it. But the story says that God is not bound by our rules and laws, and that God intentionally chose to break them. And this is what is so difficult for us. I know it's hard to imagine not being subject to all of the things that we know are true and undeniable, things that we can do nothing about. It's hard for us to imagine that there is something, anything, that is not subject to those same things. And in particular, going back from death to life. There is no answer to that problem. There is no, even with the advances we have made in medicine, with all the things that we have done and accomplished in this world, there is no answer to this problem. And here's what's sort of funny. The Bible acknowledges that, yeah, this is a bit of an issue. From 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18 through 25, he says, "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, 'I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent, I will frustrate.' Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God, for the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength." I don't want you to misunderstand what Paul is writing here when he wrote these words. He is not making fun of the people in the world who think they're so smart that they've got this all figured out. He's not. Instead, he's recognizing one simple thing. What God has done does not make sense. And the fact that it doesn't make sense is a real problem for a lot of people. And Paul can tell us exactly why it is the way it is, but it doesn't make the problem go away. The problem still exists. But it also tells us that God did what he did for a reason, and more importantly, he did not do things the way that we would have done them, either from our own sense of how it should have gone or because of our own limitations. But do you understand the absurdity of that expectation that God shouldn't have done what he did? He should have done it differently. How could God do things the way we would do them when we are so limited and he is not? Yes, it's impossible. But it's for this reason that only God could do this thing. But all this talk about what is possible, what makes sense, whether Jesus could be raised from the dead, all of those logistics and things, they are an exercise in missing the point. And the more time we spend on those things, the less time we spend talking about what is really important, which is actually the premise to the whole story. You ready for something else that's a little weird, that doesn't make a lot of sense? There is an all-powerful God who exists unto himself. That God created the world and everything in it. That God wanted to have a relationship with his creation. And in order for that relationship to work, he needed his creation to follow his lead, to listen to him, and to do some of the simple things he wanted them to do. Unfortunately, his creation could not do this, so consequently, a wedge was put into the relationship. The closeness that this God had hoped to have with his creation could not happen in the same way, but this God did not give up. Instead, he altered his plan, making allowances for the unavoidable failings of his people. Ultimately saying, I get how hard this is for you. So let me try to meet you on this. God compromised over and over again. He raised them up and let them fall. He performed wonders, sent messengers, worked tirelessly to keep his people close, yet no matter how much he tried to keep them close, they kept pulling away. It didn't work. His creation decided again and again that they did not need this all-powerful God, when what they really wanted was an all-powerful self. Let me determine my own course. And it got so bad that those who wrestled at one time with this God decided there was nothing to wrestle with at all. For that God is not even real. Here's where it gets super weird. Against all logic, he sent his son to build a bridge to span the wedge that had become a chasm. So stay with me now. The Son of God became a man. I mean, he was born in everything. He grew up and became extraordinary. He taught like no one had before. He performed miracles that were impossible, breaking the laws that to us are unbreakable. And the world that he lived in hated him for it. Jesus tells a parable in Mark chapter 12. And we'll read it here, verses 1 through 9. A man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a pit for the wine press, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and moved to another place. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard, but they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent another servant to them. They struck this man on the head and treated him shamefully. He still sent another, and that one they killed. He sent many others. Some of them they beat, others they killed. He had one left to send, a son whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, they will respect my son. But the tenants said to one another, this is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. So they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. What then will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. While it might be clear who the bad guys are in this story, we need to turn our eyes to the landowner for a moment. And what do we see when we look at him? I'll just spoil it for you. He's a moron. He's not all that smart. He's a fool, in fact, because what did he think was going to happen? You send your servant to get what's yours, that servant is beaten up and sent back. You send another servant, that servant is treated even worse and sent back. You send a third one, that one is killed. So you send more servants, and each of them are either beaten or killed. And at some point he decides, so dumb. I'll send my son, because they'll treat him with respect. And to be fair, the decision that these renters make doesn't make sense either. Oh, you know what? If we kill the son, we get his inheritance. How? How does that work? They kill the son and send him out. But let's look at the last part. Verse 9, what then will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. So you're telling me that this guy could have sent forces to kick these guys out of his vineyard at any point, and he didn't do it. That's not rational. He's not acting like someone who is thinking this through. And why would he send his son to people that he knew were objectively terrible people that had done nothing to show that they would respect anything, let alone his son? And if he had the power to correct this, why didn't he? And by the time we get to this last part, by the time we get to verse 9, I'm sort of fed up with him, to be honest. I'm over it. And I look at verse 9 and I just say, well, yeah, okay, go now. Go kill them now. Go kick them out now. Good job. Way to think that one up. But let's make it worse. What happens if we change verse 9? What if instead, after all of this, the landowner didn't send an army to kick out these guys? What if he instead decided to take all the loss and improve the land so that the tenants could stay on it? And then promise them that at his mansion, his house, which was more than they could ever dream of, that he would prepare special places and wings for them to come and live when they're tired of working in the vineyards. What would we do with that story? How would we look at him then? To pile irrational on top of stupid, on top of foolish, till we'd boil it all down and we're left with crazy. But don't you see? It's not the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus that doesn't make sense. If God's an all-powerful God, then he can do what he wants. And life and death have no bearing on his choices. Those things cannot stand against him any more than a water gun could stand against a forest fire. But that's not really what's important about this story. Do you know what the biggest mystery, the greatest disconnect, the weirdest thing about this story is? Do you know what really makes no sense at all? It's the fact that God did these things because he loves us. The fact that he went this far to offer us redemption, it is that which is utterly ridiculous. God didn't send his son simply hoping we would listen to him. He sent his son here to die for us, that through his resurrection we might have eternal life with God. We who have tried to take the vineyard from him, we who have killed his son, said, through the death of my son, you can now come live with me forever. It is not the great power of God that defines the way that things are. It is his outrageous love that swoops in and says, I will do the truly impossible for you. Therefore, I rejoice in the ways that this story doesn't make sense. And I, for one, am grateful that God was not restrained by the laws and the rules of this world. I am grateful that God did not do what we think made the most sense. I'm grateful that he does not do the things the way that I would, the only way that I would believe is possible. I am grateful that he breaks all of those things for me, for you, because let me tell you something. You know what doesn't make sense? Me. I don't make sense. My life doesn't make sense. The things that happen around me don't make sense. This world doesn't make sense. And it spins every day seemingly further and further out of control. But it is into that space that even though I don't get it, and I don't even know what it really means or how it's going to look, I step up and I say, he is risen. God breaks the rules. And my God gives me the improbable victory, knowing in the end, he is the only thing that makes any sense at all.